This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Wednesday, March 27th. More clashes over the carbon tax today as Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe took his case against it to Parliament Hill. Just ahead, we'll ask Moe whether he has an alternative climate plan. Plus, federal Liberals start to roll out their budget measures. Coming up, what today's announcement means for renters, and later, the power panel on whether the Liberals have any runway to win back voters. We begin with the ongoing fight over the carbon tax. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe testified before a House of Commons committee today, making his case against it.
That is making life more unaffordable for not only Saskatchewan residents, but all Canadians as a whole. It's making industries less competitive. Those are industries.
Moe is one of seven premiers pushing to halt the planned carbon tax hike coming next week. New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs is expected to testify tomorrow. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister says it's basic math that the tax does more to help Canadians and is challenging the premiers who are against the federal plan to present their own.
That if they really don't like our approach to pricing pollution, they can develop their own approach.
Scott Moe is the Premier of Saskatchewan, and he joins me now. Premier, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, David.
You and your colleagues have challenged the Prime Minister to pause or scrap the carbon tax. He has challenged you and your colleagues who oppose carbon pricing to come up with an alternative plan. What's Saskatchewan's alternative to the federal plan?
Well, Saskatchewan's alternative plan doesn't involve pricing our industries that are creating wealth or creating jobs and creating opportunity for Saskatchewan people, and doing so all the while producing some of the most sustainable food, fuel, and fertilizer that you can find on Earth. And so the goal shouldn't be, how much we can force industries to pay. The goal should be, how do we attract investment, develop innovation that is driving down the actual emissions in our industries, and then turn around and sell that innovation to the world. There's avenues for this, and this has been Saskatchewan's approach all along. You don't have to have a price on carbon or a carbon tax in order to solve climate change, and I think the United States is proving that to be true.
So a question on that. The opposition to this point has largely been about the retail carbon tax, the consumer carbon tax, the fuel charge, for example. But are you talking about getting rid of industrial pricing as well? Is that your position?
No, the consumer carbon tax has to go. It's just an inflationary cost on families. What we're saying when it comes to the industrial pricing mechanisms, we have one provincially led here in the province. We put forward a heavy emitter policy in place where we had created a tech fund, and the companies have realistic targets that they are achieving. So there isn't a lot of money in the tech fund, but they're achieving it through making their own investments in reducing their emissions in various different ways that are different even among industries in the same area of the province. And so you need to allow for those that innovation in that particular industry or that particular segment of the industry. You need to give them some room to make the investments that are necessary. And so it's happening here in the oil industry, the mining industry, the ag industry, all the industries that we have is happening. It's happening very ambitiously and it doesn't need necessarily to have a carbon tax on it. We do have that heavy emitter fund in place, but I would say that they're making the investments to avoid that fund.
But if you look at the math that's come out in terms of where Canada's emissions have gone under these policies, the Climate Institute says the consumer carbon price has reduced emissions by 8 to 10%. The industrial pricing policy is doing the heavy lifting of 30 to 40% of the reductions, and say that can be tweaked and used even further to get rid of emissions. If they are working, and if this is the goal to reduce emissions, how do you argue for getting rid of them if fighting climate change is, in fact, a goal?
So we're not arguing anything in the heavy output space. What we're saying is allow the provinces to run their own funds, and that's what we are doing here in the province of Saskatchewan, and it is working. Like I said, we're producing some of the most sustainable products that you can find on Earth. And I think other provinces would have a similar narrative to tell around whatever it is they do in their respective province. The consumer carbon tax does nothing but make life more unaffordable for, in our case, Saskatchewan residents, but we would say all Canadians, whether it's at the grocery store, whether it's when you fuel your pump up. And so that's the official ask at this point, is to put a pause on the increase that's coming on Monday for all Canadians. It'll be 17 cents on a liter of gas here in Saskatchewan. But our stance has always been that we should remove the consumer carbon tax off of everything for everyone.
But you say, okay, you say it's working. First of all, the Bank of Canada says the carbon tax is only responsible for 0.1 percentage points of annual inflation. So the central bank argues that it's not the inflationary monster that it's being portrayed as in this. So it is having some input there. You're arguing that they pause it, scrap it. They've made clear they're not going to do it. Your argument comes as one of the only provinces, if not the only province, without a legislated emissions plan that shows your path to reducing emissions in your province by 2030. I mean, wouldn't your argument carry more weight if you could point to an actual targeted plan of 2030 saying, here's how we're getting here, here's where we're going to be, so you don't need to do what you're doing? You don't have that right now to put on the table.
Certainly we do. We have a plan out to 2050 within our electrical sector. We have real-life examples of what's happening, for example, in our oil industry that has reduced their methane emissions by 65%. We have an agriculture industry that is producing far less emissions on a per-ton basis. Canola and wheat are 64% lower than the next seven largest competitors around the world. Saskatchewan most certainly is doing its part in attracting in innovation into each of those industries, attracting investment into each of those industries. And then we're turning around and not only utilizing that investment and lowering emissions here, but using that investment and selling that investment in other areas of the world so that they can do the same. And the most recent example was 1,000 zero-till drills were sold to farms in India so that they can sequester carbon into their soils, much like we are doing now.
Right. I know you have policies. I'm not saying you have no policies, but your emissions that I have here, the latest information I can find on the Government of Canada website is that in 2021, it was 67.1 megatons. And there's no target set by the Saskatchewan government. It is what all the literature and the economic and environmental analysts are saying. So if you say you have a target for 2030, what is it? Where is this 67.1 megatons going to be in 2030?
Well, you can offset the ag emissions in there with respect to not recognized today, but should be recognized in the very near future with the carbon sequestration that is going into our soils due to the zero-till drills, to the offsetting emissions due to precision agriculture and GPS technology. If we were able to work with our federal government and provide an internationally traded mitigation outcome through Article 6 of the Paris Accord, we could then capture those carbon credits from those 1,000 air drills that were sold to farms all over India as well. And so the fact that, I guess my question is do you want a plan or do you want results? Because what is happening in Saskatchewan is actual results in carbon sequestration, reducing our methane emissions in the oil field. Our potash has a 50% lower carbon footprint than the next largest competitors in Belarus and Russia. We're producing results here in Saskatchewan. The federal government is not working with the province or our industries on recognizing those results, but it doesn't mean that they aren't results nonetheless. And so if you want a plan, I suppose you could discuss that with the federal government. If you want actual results on what is happening in the most sustainable supply of food, fuel, and fertilizer, you can come to Saskatchewan and see for yourself.
But I guess, Premier, you look at the numbers that are publicly posted. It's Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta where the emissions are either flat or rising. And in other places, they're going down because of the measures. So you say you're getting results, but the numbers would suggest that you're at best holding steady, if not increasing. Certainly over the last 20 years, emissions in Saskatchewan have been on the rise.
Yeah, they're unrecognized results. And that's an issue. That's an issue in this whole conversation. If you're not going to recognize when industries are actually making impactful changes, how do you expect to incentivize those industries to continue to support the policy development that you have? And so, herein lies the entire problem of the old unconsulted policy that was introduced back in 2016, I believe, October the 3rd. I was one of the environment ministers in that meeting when we were told Prime Minister is going to rise in his place and he's going to ask you to put in place a plan, or he's going to impose one on you. And that's ultimately what's happened in the majority of provinces, is he is imposing his will on Canadians. And so, up until recently, we've taken this through every legal aspect available. We've always thought that it is a harmful tax. But at least outside of Quebec, it was being imposed somewhat fairly. Recently, with the decisions around home heating fuel in Atlantic Canada, we can no longer say that's the case. It's still a harmful tax, but it isn't even being imposed fairly across Canada to Canadian families outside of Quebec, where it's always been I always had some incentive in that particular province. And so This creates a real problem. And I think our original stance of this harmful tax needs to be removed on everything for everyone is true. I do believe truly that is going to happen either by this administration or the next.
Right. And look, it's home heating oil in Atlantic Canada, not all fuels. And it is applied nationally, even though it was driven by the politics of Atlantic Canada because of the specific.
It should be all fuels.
No, I understand your position on that. And we've talked to Minister Duncan on the show about this a couple of times. And that's where I want to go next. Is you say you've tried every legal avenue to challenge this, going to court. Now it's really become a political argument against carbon pricing. But you stop collecting and remitting the carbon tax on home heating fuels in your province in protest of what you consider to be the double standard. This is illegal, as you know. Has the Canada Revenue Agency or anyone contacted you or your government to inquire about the failure to pay the remittance to the federal government that you're legally supposed to be collecting?
And just reaching out to collect a tax that the federal government at the Supreme Court of Canada had argued for persistently that is not a tax. And so we'll see how that goes. The fact of the matter is what we saw happen is Canadian families are not being treated fairly. And so we took the action that we could to treat to the degree that we can Saskatchewan families as fairly. And we mirrored the federal government's decision. And I think it's a pretty disappointing state of affairs in our nation when a provincial government makes exactly the same decision as the federal government did, and now you have a federal minister saying that it's creating anarchy in one area of the nation, but not in the area where they made that decision, and questioning the morality of one government's decision when they really mirrored what the federal government decision was. And so this is disappointing for us that it's at this date, and I would hope that it's disappointing for all Canadians. And we'd ask the right thing to be done, which is to forego the carbon tax on all forms of home heating oil for all forms of home heating for all Canadians.
But Premier, you know how the division of powers works, right? I mean, you can't make a decision about a federal tax any more than the federal government can make a decision about the pronoun policy you're implementing that they have criticized so heavily. They can't interfere in your jurisdiction that way. So, I mean, how do you square, you know, the demands to respect jurisdiction with you as a premier who took an oath, not applying federal law in your province?
I think very shortly you are going to see Canadians that are going to make a decision at the polls. The tax is finally being seen by all Canadians for what it exactly is. It's a harmful inflationary tax that was shown in Saskatchewan when we did remove the home heating carbon tax on natural gas and electricity. We're now 1 point below on the CPI, the average across Canada. And that Statistics Canada said that was due to us removing the carbon tax just off our home heating bills in Saskatchewan. Can you imagine if the 17 cents came off a liter of gasoline, what that would do for the national consumer price index, our inflationary rates, and ultimately the interest rates that we've seen increase 10 times in the last 2 years. And so, listen, I'm disappointed that Saskatchewan has had to come to a point where we're mirroring a federal government's decision, and that's being deemed as not being lawful. That's tremendously disappointing for me. It's not why I ran for this position, and it's, I think, tremendously disappointing for many Canadians if that's the state of our nation today, that we have a federal government that ultimately is going to be working towards or threatening throwing a provincial minister in jail for a motion that was passed in our legislature and voted on unanimously by every single member in the legislature, not just our party, every single member in the legislature from all parties.
But the Saskatchewan legislature doesn't make federal law, right? Just as a final point, like, you know this, right? And you were aware of this before you took this course of action. And I get the political fight, and this will probably be resolved at the ballot box. But, you know, you're a lawmaker, you're a premier, you're supposed to uphold laws. This seems problematic for the office you hold and the actions you're taking.
Seems tremendously unfair to Canadian families that the federal government would make a decision like this. I'm disappointed that we had to come to, really the motion that came in our house. I wasn't surprised that it was supported by all parties. Every single MLA, 61 MLAs in the house, supported this motion. We have no choice but to represent the interests of Saskatchewan people. That's what we're elected to do, and that's precisely what we're doing in this case.
Premier Scott Moe, I've gone over time. Thank you for speaking with us today. Appreciate it, sir. A federal inquiry into foreign interference resumed public hearings in Ottawa today. The first to testify will be members of several diaspora communities, some who have said they felt threatened by foreign actors.
The commission must walk a very fine line in its work. People who are subject to transnational repression by foreign regimes may have very real fears in speaking publicly about their experiences, and as a result, the Commission will likely have to offer some witnesses protections that are at odds with fully open proceedings.
The CBC's Karina Roman is monitoring these hearings and joins us now live. So, Karina, what did we hear from the testimonies today?
So just to go over some of the groups we heard of so that our audience knows who we heard from Iranian-Canadian group, Chinese-Canadian groups, Sikh groups, Russian-Canadians, all with very similar stories about how these threats are manifesting themselves, threats to individuals here in Canada, threats to their families back home, examples of the ways that they get pressure to do things against their will by these foreign state actors, the travel bans they face so they can't even go home to see dying relatives, that they're followed, that they're harassed. One person talked about his tires being slashed. The disinformation that these governments put out to discredit them, the fake emails that have been sent in their name to MPs here in Canada to discredit them. They also talked about the lack of Canadian support based on their experience with both police and the Canadian government. Also, the naivety they feel that the Canadian government has about how pervasive this foreign interference is, but also just examples of visas being given or permanent residency being given to someone from perhaps, you know, the Iranian regime as an example. How can that happen when you know what they're doing back in Iran? And then, of course, they talked about the impact, David, the chilling effect that this has had, of course, on the diaspora communities who want to speak out or want to take a stand or fight for rights back home, but also the chilling effect it can have on politicians and political parties and how that works. And we heard from the leader of the Sikh Association who, you know, said, well, you want to talk about impact. Well, they literally killed the guy in terms of the Sikh leader who was assassinated in British Columbia. They talk about communication being cut with their families because it's just too risky for their families. The list literally seemed endless in terms of the threats and the impacts that they go through.
Yeah, so many different countries, so many different communities, the consistent through line of it all is they feel vulnerable, unheard, and alone in dealing with a lot of this, at least up to this point. So that they're laying that out today. It's going to continue in tomorrow. What comes next, Karina, in these public hearings?
The list of witnesses is very long, but next we will hear from Elections Canada officials. Eventually, over the course of the next couple of weeks, we'll hear from political parties, we'll hear from MPs, both those that have been targeted by foreign governments, but also those with ties, alleged ties that are too close to those governments, senior public servants, cabinet ministers, security establishment officials, the prime minister at some point eventually. Really what they're looking at is what's been going on, especially in pertaining to the 2019 and 2021 elections, what impact that has had, and also, as you know, the flow of information within government, because so much has been criticized about how that's worked against Canada's resilience against foreign interference, and so what can be improved on that side of things.
Okay, Karina, thank you so much. That's the CBC's Karina Roman. The Liberal government is starting to roll out some planks of this year's budget. Today's focus, rent. The government wants to launch a new $15 million tenant protection fund that would help legal aid organizations better protect tenants from unfair rent increases, rent evictions, or just bad landlords. The Liberals also want to create a new Canadian Renters Bill of Rights. It would require, in part, for landlords to disclose a clear history of apartment pricing so renters can bargain fairly. And finally, the government wants to amend the Canadian Mortgage Charter to ensure that renters receive credit for the money they pay for rent over the years. Marcy Ian is the Minister for Women, Gender, Equality and Youth. She's in Toronto, where she was part of one of the announcements today. Minister, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be with you. How are you?
I'm good. You're announcing these proposals. They're your ideas, but they're not entirely within your jurisdiction to implement. A couple of them are going to need at least the cooperation or consultation of provinces, banks, and maybe even some landlords. How quickly can Canadians expect to see any of this in place?
Well, if the young people that I met with today are any indication, sooner rather than later. It really is tough right now, and I have to start there. I was just at Toronto Metropolitan University just before coming to be with you, and we heard from about 60 to 70 young people. I was there with Sean Fraser, the Minister of Housing, Arif Virani, the Minister of Justice, and they were talking to us about the things that they're facing. They are trying to get into rental buildings that they can't get into because they're priced too high. They are trying to struggle, some of them, because when you look at youth, you're looking at 15 to 30, have young families, and they're going to school. There are all these different things happening, and the bottom line is that, you know, and I said this time and time again, it isn't about young people being window dressing. They have to be part of the solution. So we are listening to them, and actually they are taking the lead on this and telling us what they need, which is why you're seeing what you're seeing today.
Right, but times are tough right now, but bluntly, times have been tough for a while. Especially when it comes to housing, especially when it comes to housing supply, especially when it comes to rental rates, and certainly now there's a mortgage wave coming. So like these policies won't be in place for a while, just like the housing accelerator announcements are going to take some time to hit the market and do things. So it's a bit of a lag in when the problem manifests into what we're seeing.
I wouldn't say that at all. I have seen so much change when it comes to the Rapid Housing Initiative. In my own riding of Toronto Centre, there are apartment buildings that I have been to, structures, there are restaurants that were restaurants before and are now housing, you know, families that have 3+ people in them. The Rapid Housing Initiative has done a lot. And as you know, this is going to take all levels of government to address this situation. Municipalities across the country, partnered with the federal government, have done so much. And this is just another tier. What you're seeing today is just another tier and a focus, though, on young people who need a lot right now. And I have to say it's interesting, David. There was a young man there today who was talking about childcare. And I looked at him. I didn't expect to hear about childcare today, but he said, I'm actually saving my child. Our family is benefiting from $10 a day childcare. And now having, you know, tenants have rights, making sure that organizations like Acorn, who we also met with today, can stand up for tenants who are being mistreated by landlords, making sure that when people have a great rental history, which is important, that it matters and it means something when you're applying for a mortgage. These are things that young people care about. These are things that we care about. And as I said, we are taking their lead. This is just one of several things that are going to roll out as we lead up to the budget.
We had two sets of numbers, though, today. One from StatsCan shows the population grew by over 1 million. And one from Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation that shows that the number of home starts are expected to go down this year. And that's two key numbers. One flat, I think, is what we could say. Single homes, family homes, down by 20%. It's offset by a surge in apartment construction, which may increase the number of units available, but it's not keeping up with the pace, right? So there's still this overarching challenge. So I know this was about rent today.
Yes.
Are we going to see a lot more on housing between now and the budget and in the budget?
I am confidently saying yes on that. We know that housing and affordability are top of mind for Canadians. It's what I hear every day in Toronto and across the country. It's what we all hear, and that's what we're addressing. I have to say, though, that, you know, we are dealing with, 30 years of inertia on housing, where the federal governments, didn't really wade into this sphere. And in 2015... we made a commitment to do more in 2017 and beyond. We most certainly did with different housing programs. And it takes time. And I know that that's not what people want to say, but an affordability crisis, a housing crisis, is not going to be solved in a day. But what I can tell you is with the young people that I've been with, I'm just back from Winnipeg and then today at TMU, and that I've heard from, you know, for the past couple of years, there is hope. There really is hope. I've had people talk to me about the first-time home savings account and the fact that they were able to buy a house because they were able to save. It's going to take a lot of hard work, but we're on a path and on a path that federal governments before us haven't been on. And we're happy to do this in concert with our provincial and municipal colleagues and partners.
Well, there was a much greater role in federal role in housing in the 1980s in particular. But like under the Chrétien government, the Martin government, the Harper government, there was a pullback.
There was a huge pullback.
But your government's been in power for 8 years, right? And it's really taken sort of an interest rate crisis and this giant shift in public opinion polls to sort of bring an urgency to this issue, at least in terms of boosting housing supply.
No, I disagree respectfully, David. This has been something that we've been working on for years, but it's housing, it's indigenous issues and trying to rectify those things. There's so much work to be done. It is putting women and gender equality at the forefront and all that comes with that. There are so many issues, and we have been really dealing with all of them. Whether or not this is the issue that is top of mind, there would be, you know, no argument. It is affordability. Make no mistake. But we have been there, and we continue to be there.
The specific focus today from the Deputy Prime Minister and the Prime Minister on Gen Z and millennials. Millennials were a big part of the government's win in 2015, but a voting cohort that, if you read the polls, has been shifting away over the past year. This seems like a pretty clear start of a play to specific generations of voters to address their issues and try to pull them back.
As the Minister of Youth, I talk to young people. I'm with them all the time. And we've been there for them and continue to be. It's about listening to what they need and acting. Governments aren't about just listening, they act, and that's what we're doing. I think about so many of the things. I mentioned I'm just back from Winnipeg and met with so many groups there, some groups that help unhoused kids, some groups that help, you know, women with kids. There's so much in this realm, David, and we continue to be there. It's just that we are in crisis mode now. We've not seen crises like this in a very long time when it comes to housing, when it comes to affordability. But make no mistake, it's all hands on deck. And I will say my youngest advisors are my best advisors.
Right.
The Prime Minister was the first Minister of Youth. There's a Prime Minister's Youth Council, of which he leads, and I'm the Vice Chair. And young people have access to the halls of power, and we make it so, because we don't only want to hear from them, we want to act on what they're telling us. And this today is proof of that.
I know responsibility for the housing challenges in the country go beyond the federal government, municipal governments, provincial governments. They all play a big role in this. But you just said an interesting phrase. You said we're in crisis mode now.
Yes.
Governments have to manage crises, but also avoid them. I mean, do you think all levels of government, including your own, have done a good job of seeing what was coming with the high population growth we've had over the last 8 years and the low housing growth we've had over the recent and avoiding what is now a crisis compounded by the affordability challenges and the interest rate challenges?
It's such a great question that you ask, because as soon as I thought crisis mode, I thought about when I was elected, and that was 2020, and we were in the middle of the pandemic. So, you know, governments prove themselves when they can handle situations that they don't expect. And I was, you know, a reporter, as you know, before, and covered a bit of the government's handling of what was a huge crisis in the COVID crisis. And, you know, lessons learned from that, huge lessons learned from that. But we served Canadians well and continue to serve them well. So it's not just about, you know, the crises you deal with when they come, it's how you handle the ones that you don't know are coming. And we are here now. We aren't making, you know, any mistake you know, mincing words with regards to how bad this is. It's bad. But this is what you do as a government. You react and you call and pull in other governments and say this is all hands on deck.
Right.
And these issues, many of them aren't partisan issues. You just get together, you do the work, and you serve Canadians. And frankly, that's what they want to see. And young Canadians, more than ever, They want to see action from all levels of government.
So,
and that's what we're doing, and that's what we're prepared to do moving on.
So this is a budget announcement some 19, 20, 21 days ahead of the actual budget, which is not set until April 16th. I've got news releases in my inbox telling me there's going to be childcare announcements tomorrow connected to the budget. How many of these are we going to see between now and budget day? Five, six, 10, 12?
Why don't I just say lots? How about I say, David, there's lots more to come. And I do think that there's something about bite-sized pieces, about letting Canadians know what's coming and understanding, are they engaged? Is this something Canadians care about? What's the reaction? That's what, you know, the town hall with young people was about today. How do you feel about this? Are we on the right track with this? You told us this, and so we're now moving ahead. Give us more, because we need to hear from you. So in these bite-sized pieces that you're going to see, Canadians will be able to understand what is ahead, what will be in the budget come April 16th, and we'll be able to gauge, but also let them know how we're serving them in the days ahead.
Minister Marcy Ian, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Stay well.
Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe testified before a House of Commons committee today, making his case against the carbon tax, and that led to some feisty exchanges.
This cost is not helping.
I don't mean to interrupt the Honourable Premier, but I do have a point of order here.
You are interrupting, though.
The Prime Minister asked you to come up with a plan, so I'm pleading with you, come up with a plan.
There is another way. Never say never.
You're of the opinion, never say never, but it sounds like kick the can down the road for next generation to deal with.
We should ensure that we are making every effort to make our cleaner products available to the world.
Moe is one of seven premiers pushing to halt the planned carbon tax hike, which is coming next week. New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs, Alberta Premier Daniel Smith, they're set to testify tomorrow at committee. So what are the politics at play with all of these hearings? It's time to bring in the power panel. Emily Nicola is a columnist with Le Devoir. Amanda Alvaro is a former Liberal Party communication strategist. And here with me in the studio, Tim Powers is a former strategist for conservative parties. Jordan Leichnitz is a former NDP strategist. Emily, let's start with you in Quebec, which is not at the center of this national crisis over climate because of the cap and trade system. What do you make of what we're seeing here? A bunch of conservative premiers being invited to a conservative chaired committee to argue against a carbon tax increase that's been on the books since 2018. And meanwhile, we have all these economists and all of these environmentalists lining up on the other side of this argument against elected politicians. Where do you think this is?
I was just smiling because this was one of the most unhelpful collection of clips that I've seen.
Well, in a long time. It was representative. Let me just say, it was representative.
Exactly.
You know, and Christina, our producer, did a good job.
I'm not attacking the CBC here. I know this was representative. I just know that there wasn't a lot of space for facts there. And that tells us something in terms of the politics that's being played. And, you know, don't interrupt me. I'm speaking. You know, whatever. All of that, I'm really sorry, is very far away from the point, which is climate emergency and what to do about it. The government has been on the defensive of that for the last weeks, if not months, if not year. And so I do think that there is a point that was scored today in terms of putting that back in the hands of the premier. If you don't like what we're doing, it's up to you to actually propose something else. Politically, I think that was a smart move. And it does, you know, put the premiers on the spotlight for a change in terms of what they are proposing or not proposing to actually tackle climate change and for Canada to reduce its emission and reach its targets. And so in that way, I think that's very, very helpful. Mm. And so it doesn't just become then about this, the tax and the rebate and who gets what. It becomes about, you know, we have a policy problem. This is how we're solving it. If you think of anything better, if you think you're smarter than, you know, the economists and the environmentalists who are on the sides of that, please go ahead and put your genius idea forward.
So, Tim, I don't know what your thoughts are on this. There was a deliberate attempt yesterday with the Prime Minister with this letter that was released publicly saying to the premiers, none of you came to the table with ideas. So this is where we are. And if you don't like it, you have the power to change it. What are you going to do? Or do you not care about climate change? That's a summary of it. But that kind of captures the essence of the message. Where do you think this is now?
Well, I still think the Liberals have come at this too late. I think they should have, for them, for their own purposes, been doing this months ago. I mean, I think the Prime Minister tried out a version of this argument, what, a week or 10 days ago when, you know, he made the point that it's tough. You got to make tough decisions for the future. You don't have to be popular. I think that could have been a better argument for them if they didn't have all the vacillations that they've had on this. I mean, clearly, David, we're coming into a four-day weekend where I guess the government, the opposition, the premiers are all assuming families and people are going to get together. April 1st is coming when the next carbon price increases come. So they all want to throw their cards on the table. But I think the Liberals are way behind on this. It will be interesting to see if this and what we're going to talk about in the second segment, the housing announcement, sinks in and moves the needle at all for the Liberals. It's clearly a play. Both are to do that. Look, I agree with it. Emily, if you were one of the poor, fortunate 7,000 Canadians who, maybe it wasn't even 7,000, who had to watch that this afternoon, I'm going to buy you a Netflix subscription so you can at least see better drama. But I mean, that stuff, it's all nonsense, but it's about trying to shape conversations that are going to happen this weekend, over the next week, about this particular policy. And some of them are just layups, like Mo and the Conservatives can take the territory that they want to make these points because so much has been ceded to them. Even if there is a little bit of blowback, they still have lots of runway to recover.
You can have a climate plan, Jordan, that doesn't include a retail carbon price. You can find ways to do it without carbon pricing.
Absolutely.
But this was the hottest winter in the history of the country. There are wildfires in Alberta that have been burning since last year that the winter did not put out. The UN says the oceans are the hottest they've ever been in recorded history. None of that's going to wait for inflation to get to the lower bound of the Bank of Canada's target. So if you don't like this, fine. What are you going to do? This, I know there's conversations that need to have. This is the policy conversation the country needs to have, is it not?
Right, except we're not having a policy conversation.
No, we're not.
And I think that the circus at the committee today was really pure evidence of that. You know, this is theater, right? And you can feel the fever pitch, you know, as Tim was saying, really intensify as we get closer to April 1st. So it's a show. And I think that, you know, what's interesting is that when you saw Mo at committee today, you see also some of the limitations of the anti-carbon tax argument, right? Like when pressed, you know, we got such gems as, well, you know, companies should just reduce emissions. They shouldn't have to pay for it. So, I mean, when you really press on a lot of this stuff, it absolutely makes no sense from a policy perspective. And there is a real lack of honesty, I think, on the part of these premiers about whether they're going to simply choose another mechanism to spur emissions reductions, which is absolutely fair game, or whether there's going to be less ambition. And I think it's really much more going to be the latter. So that is a vulnerability, I think, that when you actually bring some of the anti-carbon tax rhetoric into contact with reality, at a certain point, that becomes a bit the conversation. But the other thing for the federal government is that no one's listening to the Liberals on this issue anymore. Trudeau to go out and to push with this letter and his remarks, you know, today in Vancouver, I think it's pretty ineffectual to go out and say that the premiers are lying. Nobody hears that, and it just seems to not be resonating with Canadians at all.
So Amanda, look, there is the political conversation and there is this battle for hearts and minds, and then there's the battle for the planet. And this is, you know, as a guy with two kids, 10 and younger, one of them with asthma, I worry about this quite a bit. And, you know, there is never a good time economically and from an affordability perspective to tackle massive transitional issues. So how does the conversation get there if the one big party nationally championing it is in such a credibility deficit on so many things because of where they are in public opinion that they are being tuned out?
Yeah, and as we've watched affordability issues really trump climate and environmental issues, and we've watched those issues as priorities slide down the list of priorities that Canadians deem essential or important, it does become a question. Remember, this was a central platform of the Liberal Party's campaign, right? This was, they ran on this. It was one of the reasons why they won. They had a lot of particularly young Canadians get behind them on this climate policy. So I don't think it's too late to make the case again. That's what I will say. I think that the case needs to be made. And as we see some of the lightening up of inflation and we may find ourselves in a different economic position, we could see this issue start to rise again. Right now, this is really an affordability argument that everyone's talking about, and the conservatives have effectively framed it as an affordability argument, as the liberals have failed to reframe it as an environment argument. And I think what I liked about the letter and what I liked about today was taking the liberals from the defensive position that they've been on as they've tracked against Polyev's agenda and really put them on a position of offense to be able to push back against the premiers and back against Polyev to say, fine, then what will you do? We'll join 100 economists, countless scientists to say that this is the right policy for our country right now. If you don't think it's the right policy, what is the right policy? And the silence is deafening. So to put this back on the conservative premiers, back on the conservative party leader, and ask them to have to make the case, right, I think is the right move at this juncture for the liberals.
Tim, you're not convinced? Or you are convinced? Where are you?
Amanda's making a good argument, if it were solely about the legitimacy of the policy. But back to the politics, it's not just conservatives that are running forwards or running away. Look, if you're going to win a political argument, you need allyship. And usually that allyship starts in your own tent. Last week, the New Brunswick Liberal leader stepped away from carbon pricing. The Ontario Liberal leader did the same thing. Big, powerful allies in provinces, they want to compete. The premier, our premier in Newfoundland and Labrador, long argued about the pause. He's arguably the most popular elected Liberal leader in the country. When you have Stephen Guilbeault lecturing him, as he was on a Sunday political program, about him not having a plan, the Prime Minister can invest all of this rhetoric, but if he can't even move his own people to this side because of the politics and not the policy, it's an uphill battle.
So, but Emily, this is the thing. Like, the politics is what it is, right? And Scott Moe has an election this year. Blaine Higgs has an election this year. Pierre Poilievre is locked in a double-digit lead with an election coming in the next 2 years. And I understand the political impulse there. But you have everybody who studies this for their life's work in the environmental world and in the economic world, arguing that it is the most effective, least costly, least economically damaging way to do it. And it seems to be just dismissed completely out of hand by policymakers who are arguing that gas shouldn't go up by 3 cents a liter on April 1. So I just wonder, how does the actual governing conversation happen right now with the politics that everyone rightly points out at play?
Yeah, this is why the move of what else do you have in mind is once again very interesting. I understand that it's not just conservative premiers. We do have a majority of conservative premiers in this country. And when they are liberals, or even when there is liberal oppositions in provinces, it's also up to them. I'd say it's up to every party in Canada who doesn't like the carbon tax to put forward something else. I do think that when you have a criticism for one of the most important policies for climate change becoming national headlines, then it's up to everybody who doesn't like it to suggest something else. There is a lot of apathy as well out there in terms of especially younger generations who care about climate change, who are just, when they see this kind of politics, are more likely to just stay home and not vote for anyone if nobody has something to say that's actually positive. And so there's also that risk. And so, for example, if the Ontario Liberals or if the Liberals in Newfoundland are unhappy with the carbon tax, it's also up to them to suggest something else rather than just point their fingers at Ottawa and just be uncomfortable with the fact that some people in their ridings are not happy with where their heating bills this winter.
Yeah, Jordan, to your point, it sounds like it's going to be a reduction in ambition. That's certainly kind of the impression I got from Blaine Higgs yesterday. He said, like, what's the point of us focusing hard on reducing our 1.5% of global emissions? But I want to read you something from 1980 from noted left-winger Milton Friedman. Most economists agree that a far better way to control pollution than the present method of specific regulation and supervision is to introduce market discipline by imposing effluent charges. For example, instead of requiring firms to erect specific kinds of waste disposal plants or achieve a specific water water quality and water discharge into a lake or river, impose a tax of a specified amount per unit of effluent discharge. That way, the firm would have an incentive to use the cheapest way to keep down the effluent. That is a market argument by the godfather of a lot of modern conservative thought, arguing against regulation and technological investment as the best way to deal with this.
Look, we've politicked our way around to basically deciding that the carbon tax is not something that's politically viable in Canada anymore. That's the reality. And I think that what the Trudeau government needs to do is decide, are they going to go to bat for the mechanism or are they going to go to bat for the outcome? Mm-hmm. And there are other ways of getting to reductions, right? And, you know, the Canadian Climate Institute had a report out last week looking at the importance of the industrial carbon price as a lever there. There are other ways to get at it. We had whole elections about whether we were going to do a carbon tax or cap and trade. So there's absolutely other systems and other mechanisms out there that are perhaps not as purely efficient in an economic sense, but these have to have, they have to have political buy-in. They have to be accepted by people, and that's a reality. So you can have the most beautiful policy in the world, but if nobody thinks it's legitimate, it's not going to go very far, and this is a case in point.
Okay, so Amanda, the last word to you on this, on that. If it is a good policy in the Liberals' view, but it is seen as illegitimate in the Premier's view and Canadians' view, is there a way for a shift to something that leans more heavily on industrial pricing or something other than taxing people at the pump, for example, that the Liberals might be willing to consider to save the furniture on this?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there are other ways. Do I think that they should throw in the towel right now? No, I don't. I think that they have not been effective communicators on this issue, and I think that they are, you know, changing their tune. Will they have enough time? Can they make the case with enough time? Can they put it back on the premiers to talk about how they're going to reduce emissions, how they're going to meet our climate goals? Yeah, I do think they have the time. And I think that if they're able to get their house in order and present a really clear, focused argument and really put the onus on those conservative premiers and the conservative party leader to have to answer back to Canadians, that's a lot simpler than saying we're throwing in the towel for this entire policy, a cornerstone of our original platform, and we're going to try something net new. You can imagine the heyday that Polyev would have if they decided to do something like this. So I think it's a better politics for them to try to get the communication right on this one.
Okay, they may have time. We don't. We got to take a break. Up next, the Prime Minister lays out new help for renters coming up in the 2024 budget, a budget that's still more than 2 weeks away. The Power Panel on the strategy of rolling out all these announceables early and the strategy of targeting young voters. That's next. The Prime Minister and the Finance Minister are trying a new strategy for rolling out the 2024 budget, making announcements early. Trudeau started today with a commitment aimed at young renters.
Today we're announcing new protections for renters and new pathways to home ownership. As part of our upcoming budget, we're going to create a Canadian Renters Bill of Rights.
Will this new strategy help win over the Gen Z and millennial voters they talked about today? The Power Panel is back on that. Jordan Lightness, Tim Powers, Amanda Alvaro, and Emily Nicola. So, Amanda, early, specific announcements prior to the budget, one today, I think just childcare stuff coming tomorrow, and a bunch more over the next 2 weeks, really aimed at people under the age of 45, let's say. What do we make of this?
I love this. Slow clap for the Liberals. Hallelujah. Thank you for this decent communications strategy. Whoever thought of this one is doing absolutely the right thing. And this is why. We have been rolling out budgets the same way for decades, right? It's all in a shroud of secrecy, and then the news goes out on one day and you get your big one-hit wonder, and then you try to do something called echo announcements where you try to keep these announcements for alive for weeks on end afterwards. So challenging, because the day of the budget announcement, of course, all of your opponents have equal airtime, you know, to voice all of their concerns about what you've just announced. Rolling out specific budget measures pre-budget is a brilliant way of putting the spotlight on the things that you want to talk about, but giving them their sort of discrete moment. And I love this strategy. I will guarantee you that other provinces, other governments will follow suit. This was a smart, smart move. And in the case of this first announcement, getting, you know, probably more of its share than the other announcements, really signaling to Canadians and to young Canadians about the issues that they're going to hear about in the budget. They talked about things like fairness, Obviously, they went out with rent. We know housing has been a big issue. Poly have helped to make it a huge issue. So the fact that they're going out with this right out of the gate and that they're targeting young Canadians is a signal of the kinds of things to expect as we move closer to budget day.
Okay, so Tim, we're going to put Amanda down as undecided on the strategy. But you know, not to make everything about Newfoundland, but you're here and I'm here. Brian Tobin used to do this.
Yeah.
Danny Williams used to do this, like for the weeks leading up to the budget. One or two specific things would come out. We're going to, like, this has been done by other governments. It's just taken a long time for it to be embraced.
Doug Ford was just doing this in Ontario. Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. Like, so we, but it's interesting to see it. What did you make of what they picked and the way they did it and who they're targeting?
Well, Emily was talking about some of the data earlier, and she was right in the sense that two elections ago and perhaps in the last election, Gen Zs and millennials, the first issue was environment. That's been leapfrogged, as it has in every demographic, by affordability. And the number one affordability issue for most Gen Zs and millennials is housing. So if you want to get back in the game with Polyev, and you got to say something more than axe the tax because you're sticking with the tax, you got to come back with something that you can focus on. And again, focus people's thinking going into this particular long weekend. I mean, the Liberal government has never been bad at taking out the fire hose and spraying money around or promises of hope around. They need to do it. They've had more ministerial announcements this week than I've seen in a very long time. You look at any local media outlet across the country where there are still people working, and you will find stories of Liberal ministers being in town dropping checks all over. I mean, this is old school, but it can work. Again, will it move the dial? That is the key thing to watch. I mean, I'm going to be watching our data for the next 2 weeks to see what happens in that the two cohorts of 18 to 40, the Zs and the millennials. Does it move? Does it penetrate? Because all of this going out in the mainstream is also good, but that isn't necessarily where the people this announcement is targeted to are consuming news. So I would love to know what their social strategy is and all of that, because that's going to be vital if they're going to have success here.
But Jordan, it is interesting with the focus on, I don't know if it's Gen Z or Gen Z. It depends, you know, if you're Canadian, America, whatever.
I was going to say, it's Gen Z.
Yeah, I know. CBC, don't get mad at me. And millennials, but like, they are so underwater with male voters,
right?
It's a generational play and a gender play that they have available to them.
That's right.
And we're seeing the generational play here. Childcare is coming tomorrow, apparently. That is the gender play, probably. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is signs of life. I think I share some of Amanda's enthusiasm for seeing a strategy. I think it's smart to get out. This is the right topic. They are able to set the table on the issue. Now, I mean, I think the questions that I would have is, you know, this announcement, it's pretty small ball, really, in terms of what you're, like, we're talking about negotiating with the provinces to eventually create some sort of bill of rights. So it's, this is all kind of pretty far off in the distance in terms of how it would actually impact people. And, you know, to echo a bit what Tim said, I have my questions about whether those voters are actually consuming the media where this stuff is going to be reported. They're hard to reach without paid content right now. And we know that that's something the Liberals have been struggling with. So, well, I think it's a smart strategy to use what they have better. I also think that the Prime Minister as a messenger is pretty weak right now. And you know, you've seen, I think, Sean Fraser, he's been able to get a bit of a toehold over time.
He was in Toronto today.
Yes.
The Echo announcement, the big market where all the Liberal seats are.
Right? Exactly. So I think, you know, he's certainly had a bit of success getting through into regular mainstream media. But in terms of how that actually translates into reaching those younger voters, I have my doubts.
Right. You know, but Emily, to Amanda's point that, you know, $15 million to help people fight, you know, rent evictions and things like this, talking about developing a renter's bill of rights. And the interesting thing here is the idea that your rent payments get included into your credit score as you go to get a mortgage, that if you've been reliably making rent, that might be able to help you. These are things that would be overshadowed on budget day, but it gets carried live and gets, you know, a day of conversation today. So going back to the signs of life point, what do you make of the pulse we saw today from the Liberals?
Well, the first point I'd make is that those are budget announcements that aren't really about budget, in the sense that it's not about throwing money out there. Of course, there's a cost to everything, but those are very small cost announcement. When it comes, for example, to controlling the price of rent, one of the main issues is the lack of transparency, lack of information in terms of the history of how is the unit that you're looking at, how was it priced beforehand? And so forcing more transparency on this is, yes, there is some cost to running any website, but at the same time, it's very, very low cost when you compare it to the impact that this could have. And so it's a budget announcement, but at the same time, it could have been an announcement on really mm-hmm. anything. It didn't need to be something that's tied to the budget. So there is that I think strikes me with the announcement today. And the second thing is, yes, I don't think it's very conducive to a very good learning information digesting environment to lock people up in a room for 8 hours and tell them that they have to digest 400 pages of information and just communicate it to as clear as possible to the masses for a day and have all those special shows where we fill air times with speculation because the budget is not out yet. I don't think that's an exercise that benefits the government, doesn't benefit mm-hmm. the opposition, doesn't benefit the interest parties that are struggling to have their press release ready by 4 o'clock on that day while nobody's going to actually look it up because there's just so many other things going on. And silly doesn't serve, journalists who are exhausted by the end of the day, and that's not necessarily the best way to get quality of information either. And so if we're going to deconstruct that piece by piece in terms of communication exercise, I do think that it's smart. It serves the government, but I also just think that it serves the public in general so that we have more time to analyze and figure out which the decisions our governments are taking. Usually when you have an omnibus bill, it's because the government has something to hide. Mm. And so we've been having budgets as basically omnibus bills for decades. And if this communication strategy helps us pause and look at what is it that the government can hide in a budget because there's so many announcements in one day, I think democracy is served by having information, paced out in a way that people can actually digest it.
Okay, you're speaking to my soul. As the guy who has to go into that budget lockup every year and try to understand 400 billion dollars worth of spending and then race out, sit next to Rosemary and in 3 minutes explain the narrative of the budget. I mean, you're dead right. If it can be done in a way that is more understandable and comprehensible, I think that's good for the citizens of the country, Amanda, good for the journalists of the country, and the liberals, I think, would hope it's good for the current government of the country, because this is very clearly, they're kind of, it's almost like a platform rollout. You know what I mean? They're going to, if they do what we're being indicated they're going to do, it's plank by plank by plank building up to budget day, almost like you see during a campaign to match the campaign footing Pierre Poilievre has been on.
For sure. And that's why this works, right? Because we're not losing. There's subtle things that they'll want to talk about within the context of the budget or, groups of individuals that they'll want to talk to. And those things get missed. They get buried under the big numbers or under, frankly, the agenda that some of the other parties have to drive the narrative after a budget has been set. So to really parcel out some of these nuggets, especially some of these smaller announceables, give them the time to really share what it is, the core of that story. And I agree with Tim, it's doesn't just come down to mainstream news, as important as mainstream news is, but also finding ways to dig down into how are these individuals consuming their news? And is it through podcasts? Mm-hmm. And how are we reaching them through social media? And that's a really difficult challenge for political parties, right? As somebody who works with brands all the time, a disproportionate amount of money is being spent on influencers and how we use influencers mm-hmm. to disseminate messages on social. That's not possible in politics. So how else can you reach those individuals through social channels? That will be the next big leap, and we'll see a ton of that in the next election.
Yeah, and by the way, you can get a curated version of this show on wherever you get your podcast, the Power and Politics podcast. But Tim, a lot of this stuff just as a final point on rent and the things that they want to deal with. They need the provinces.
Again.
Right, and look at where we started the day. right? Now, it's in their mutual self-interest to all deal with this, but so is saving the planet, you could argue. I mean, how quickly do you think they can get this done, and what kind of like cooperation do you think they're going
to have? Well, I think last time there was the federal government had a stick when it came to health care and daycare, and that they were a new government and they had cash. What's the cash component of all this, particularly as it relates to builds, and where's that money going to come from? Because you have provinces saying we have to provide infrastructure and services now. In other areas, if we're going to do this around rent, how are you going to pay us? The thing I would say, though, before we crown this as the sublime genius of a regenerated Trudeau regime, let's recognize a pattern here, though, too. There is a little bit of a pattern here. Remember, it's like we're back in the 1700s. These guys love bills of rights and codes of conduct. How's that grocery code of conduct going, by the way? Grocery prices are still going up. They're down a little bit in terms of the pace that they're going up, but they're still going up, right? So is this gimmick that will be seen for that or something that can be substantive? And that's, again, a credibility challenge that the Liberals still have to bear. Sounds good, but what will it be?
Some food prices are actually falling, but it has nothing to do with anything happening in Canada. It's all because of global factors. Jordan, you got a final thought?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's for sure this is a better than we've seen in the past from the Liberals, but the bar is incredibly low. So I think that we'll have to wait and see how it lands with people. But I'm struck by, you know, on the question of qualifying for a mortgage, like it's great if you can use rent history, but who can actually afford a mortgage now of these young people? So a lot of this is also down to what happens with interest rates as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, the Bank of Canada is looming over Canadian politics in a big way. All right, gang, I appreciate it. It was a fun conversation. Thank you to the Power Panel, Jordan Likeness, Tim Power, Amanda Alvaro, and Emily Nicola. Thanks so much, gang.
Thank you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochran. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.